Conrad, thank you very, very much. Thanks for your invitation to be here. Thanks for your warm introduction. And mostly, thank you for the wonderful work that you have done in the housing field for our communities and cities across the country. Conrad was an integral member of the HUD team in the years that I was there, working hard at FHA, and he's done a fabulous job in the years since building the National Housing Conference. Conrad is joined in preparations for this event by Lynn Ross, who is responsible for putting together this first ever conference of the National Housing Conference for state and local officials and local housing persons. Lynn, thank you. And also present is Jeff Lubell, who runs the housing research policy work at the National Housing Conference. All of those great reports are a result of Jeff and his staff. So let's recognize Jeff as well. Congratulations. And the whole National Housing Conference staff, I've had the privilege of working with them the last several years, including this year in the event that was held in June, where we recognized Ron Terwilger for his years of work in the housing field. And it's not, therefore, a surprise to me when I read on the plane here, as I read my backup materials, that 2 weeks ago, the MacArthur Foundation, which gives grants to over 8,000 either individuals or researchers or artists or organizations, selects among the most outstanding every year for a special award, and this year's award went to the National Housing Conference for their work in housing. So that's a nice Chicago-based angle to today's meeting, that the MacArthur Foundation based here would recognize the National Housing Conference. Thank you very much for joining us on a Sunday evening. It is testimony to your commitment to housing and putting people into homes at the local level that you would be here on a Sunday afternoon. My schedule was such this week that the only time I could be present was on the Sunday evening. But I'm pleased to see the number of other friends and housing experts that I recognize who will be part of the program over the next several days, including Bruce Katz, who now runs the Brookings Metropolitan Center and was chief of staff on our watch at HUD. And you'll hear from him tomorrow, and a number of other folks. But it's impressive to see an assembly like this ready to go to work. And what I'd like to do is share a few thoughts with you about housing policy at the local level, whether it's local government or state government or county government, or the relationship with nonprofits or the private sector or housing authorities, but the network and range of organizations that together create housing at the local level. Let me just say that there are clear reasons why housing is important to state and local officials and to nonprofits at the local level. Our cities and our communities are places where people work. They have to work economically for them to survive. They're places where people learn. They're places where people recreate. But most importantly, they have to be places where people live. And housing and cities need a mix of housing types. In my experience, if we don't create housing for working people, or beneath that, workforce housing generally discussed as 80 to 120% of median, and then beneath that at the 60% range, at the down to 30%, even 15%, which is where homeless people are, our cities can't function. And we see evidence all over the country of people who are having to drive incredible distances. In Los Angeles, it's not unusual for people to have to drive 40 miles to find workforce housing that simply doesn't exist on the economic generating west side of Los Angeles. There's evidence all over the country of this trade-off between housing cost and transportation costs. And so it is increasingly evident that cities need strategies to make sure that they have the right mix of housing, including for workers. Seattle, a few years ago, when they had those terrible floods, found themselves without the manpower to deal with the results of the floods, including down power lines that were knocked down by trees, because all of the utility workers worked long distances away and literally couldn't get in because the trees were down, the streets were down, the power was down. And so the city was paralyzed for some days as a result of the fact that the workers didn't live close enough to be able to provide the service that they're expected to provide. We see anecdotal evidence of that all over the country. We also know that housing at the local level is one of the most durable forms of economic development. Cities are struggling to find ways to sustain their economies and their jobs base, and housing provides, it's not just an adjunct to the central economic functions of a city, it is part and parcel of the economic development strategy. When I was mayor of San Antonio, I spent a lot of time on economic development. I live there now and continue to work in that arena. But it was only when I went to HUD and saw the effect that 150 homes in a community or 200 new homes in a declining neighborhood at the Northridge earthquake that Conrad made reference to, that I saw how it's possible to completely remake areas of the city using housing as the driving engine. Every one of those new rooftops is disposable income. And all of the work that local officials are doing to try to attract a neighborhood shopping center or revive a commercial district actually occurs when housing is put in place and people have disposable income to spend on those purposes. So housing ends up being part of the income and wealth strategy of a city, a very important new dimension of economic thinking in cities is the fact that cities are trying to find ways to use earned income tax credits or tax strategies or other strategies. Miami working with H&R Block, for example, is in the settlement of a strategy there. All kinds of things across the country where they're trying to recognize how do we get more income into people's hands, and more importantly than income, how do we provide access to wealth, not just income that comes in and out on a monthly basis, but savings and wealth and housing, whether it is equity and home ownership. That one's clear. We know that that is a strategy for entrance into the middle class, but also stability in rentals so that people can have the stability to be able to get a good job and raise their children. Housing is part and parcel of strategies for moving people to the middle class. There's a group in New York called the Demos Network that issued a report a couple of years ago. They called it Millions to the Middle, a strategy for moving more Americans, including minority Americans and immigrants, into the middle class to sort of restock, if you will, the backbone of American prosperity, which is the middle class. And they concluded that there were three strategies since the end of World War II that have worked to create the middle class that became the most prosperous in the world and made the United States the most prosperous country in the world during that period. One of them was access to higher education, the GI Bill after World War II, and strategies, Pell Grants, to get college education or at least community college education so people can get good jobs. A second one was the whole strategy of minimum wage and union protections and so forth that make it possible for people to have protections in the workplace, grievances, and better wages. And the third, equal strategy to those, not thought of as an income strategy, but it is, and that was the home ownership strategies and the affordable rental strategies that make it possible for people to stabilize their lives and get on the track toward savings. And then finally, it's my judgment that housing takes on a kind of spiritual or transcendental dimension. I've just seen it too many times in my work to see the effects for people when they're able to stabilize their housing situation. I saw the flip side of it at several places, several times during my work at HUD, when people had to do suddenly without housing, as in earthquake or hurricane situations where people were forced out of their homes with no warning and had to leave without all of the things that they take for granted but are part and parcel of home. When people had to leave at 4:36 in the morning of January 17, 1994 in Northridge, California because of that earthquake, and we were there within a day, the president had a team in place, I went to work on the housing issue, and 20,000 people were out of their homes. People had left instantly without their medicines, without their papers, their necessary papers, even credit cards, without their work that they'd brought home and children's homework, without their clothing and a change of clothes, without their toiletries, and they were suddenly living in parks or in shelters or in army tents that we were able to get up within days. But life without the moorings, without the attachments, without the essentials that is home, whatever form it takes, whether it is an apartment or whether it is a subsidized unit, whether it's public housing, whether it's entry-level housing, whether it's move-up housing, whatever, without a place that we call home, life is very unstable. We take it for granted, but it's incredibly important. And it's why in my work today, when we move people into homes, it's not unusual to see a lot of tears that day when people move into a home for the first time, get the keys to their home. It is such a powerful experience for them that that I know it has some spiritual dimensions to it. Well, these points on the importance of housing in the life of these places we call cities and communities are no less valid in a time of recession. In fact, there is a greater need for state and local government in a period of recession. Why? Because we're seeing an increase in homelessness as a result of the recession. I serve on the board of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, and it is now clear we are seeing more people on the streets. In fact, more women with children on the streets, increasing as people are pushed out of homes and result of foreclosure. Another dynamic, of course, that you're well aware of is foreclosures. That's a setback for families, but it's also a setback for neighborhoods and communities. As we see the results of graffiti and vandalism and price declines that affect other properties nearby, and the effects for city budgets. And we see pressure on the rental stock. There's not enough rental stock, and more people who cannot any longer stay in their homes having to go to rental. So there's a lot of dynamics, a lot of churn, if you will, in the housing markets as a result. The price declines that we're witnessing today have an effect for housing production. Builders are not building. And so I talked, for example, on Friday afternoon to an analyst who called me to talk about what the effect will be for affordability over the next few years that there's so little production today. We're going to come out of this recession without the levels of production that we've been accustomed to, and we're going to come out of this recession with pent-up demand, including increased demand from immigrants and minorities, and the result can only be another round of unaffordability, for a different reason. The last round was because too many builders were pushing upstream in what they were asking for housing and could get it in that market, and this one is likely to be driven by a different set of factors. We also see in our communities today the loss of wealth, the loss of pure, there's no other way to describe it, the loss of wealth that comes from the reduction in prices and people who have lost their homes. And with all of that, in the general community, beyond those who are directly affected, is a loss of community confidence. So there are a lot of reasons why, in a period of recession, state and local strategies, nonprofits, working together at the local level have a greater role in housing markets than ever before. Now, from my experience of both watching this from HUD and more in recent years, it is evident that the best local responses are the most comprehensive, where there are networks of housers, city, county, working with the state, nonprofits and housing authorities and others working together. I had the privilege of teaming up with Jack Kemp and Kent Colton, who used to head the Home Builders, and Nick Ritsinas, who you'll hear from, I think, day after tomorrow. And we've done two book projects together. One of them looked at bipartisan strategies for housing in the United States, how we've done best in the country when there was Democratic and Republican cooperation to advance housing policies. And from that book came a second initiative, which was to translate that into local strategies. And one of the things we did was, as a result of interviews and analyses, examine who's doing the best job in the country. And I could cite for you in different kinds of housing who's doing the best job in each of those areas. But in terms of comprehensive strategies, three cities jumped to the fore. One of them was Mayor Bloomberg's initiatives in New York. It's not an accident that Sean Donovan, the new HUD secretary, comes from the housing department of New York because he was working for a mayor who had very strong view of what he wanted to accomplish and strong goals. And probably the closest thing to being secretary of HUD is to be housing director of New York, just because of the scale of what they do there. Good job. And a second example was Boston, where Mayor Menino literally transformed the shape of the city government to create a focal point, housing as a focal point, so that it was a kind of a super cabinet function, deputy mayor for housing, with a whole series of city-related functions that in previous eras would have been disjunctive and difficult to sort of harness for housing. But as a result of the structural changes he made, they work to produce housing in Boston and create workforce housing, bring people back to Boston, and it's worked. And then the third example was the city in which we're located now, Chicago. I've heard Mayor Daley, myself, speak numerous times on this subject, and there's no more clear mayor in the country with respect to goals for housing for a city. His goals for Chicago basically are three, and it's municipal leadership backed by metrics. First, to end chronic homelessness in Chicago within 10 years. Secondly, to renovate 25,000 units of public housing. Big, big important strategy here, matching local initiatives with Hope 6, but on the whole, renovating 25,000 units of some of the worst public housing in the country. And thirdly, to build, create, generate 48,000 units of affordable housing in Chicago. And the mayor has brought the kinds of tools that local government can bring to bear. Land assembly, use of tax policies to create more land for these purposes, working the city entitlement process of approvals, city fee structures and incentives, bringing public resources to bear with a housing trust fund and other strategies of generating resources specifically for housing. Creating partnerships with what I believe is one of the most creative, if not the most creative, group of housing nonprofits in the country. Chicago is very robust in terms of the number of nonprofits that work here, as well as support from the foundation and corporate community, like the MacArthur Foundation, where Julia Stash, who runs housing at the MacArthur Foundation, was the former housing director for the city of Chicago and chief of staff in the city administration. So she knows housing at the grassroots level. And it shows in the priorities that MacArthur has articulated, for example, on preservation of housing stock. In addition, the city has tried to engage metropolitan strategies across the metro and lead in that process through a variety of metropolitan planning organizations. And the mayor has constantly, consistently set forth the metrics. In fact, the numbers that I gave you have recently been updated by the mayor and stretched out in new goals that go out now, I think, to 2015. So the strategy was successful enough that it's been upgraded and extended for a period of time. So my point is, it is possible with strong leadership and organization at the local level to create the kind of comprehensive housing strategies that incorporate all the elements. Now let me just describe for a few moments, and by the way, my intent here today is to be brief. I'm going to finish in another 10 minutes or so, and then what I'd like to do really is have a dialogue. That would be, I think, the most effective thing to do on a Sunday evening before we set you off to the reception. Let me just take a few minutes to sort of talk about a spectrum of housing that we worked on at HUD and used as kind of the template. It might be useful to you Some of you work in multiple elements of this, and others of you will work in partnership with other people. But when I say comprehensive, we generally talk in terms of sort of seven steps. Not that people go from step to step, but when I talked about cities having a mix of housing types, this is what I mean. Number one, the most basic form of housing is shelter for people who are homeless. So that's sort of basic. As I say, when I became Secretary of HUD, a wise friend said to me, your first job as the Secretary of the Cabinet Department whose name begins with housing is to be responsible for those Americans who are completely unhoused. We have 800,000 people on the streets of America on any given night. The number is growing. Because it's not the same people week to week or month to month, the number is actually 3.5 million different Americans in the course of a year. That's a city bigger than the city of Chicago, sleeping on the streets of American cities. And we need more shelter beds. So the strategy of reaching out to people, bringing them off the streets, and putting them in at least temporary facilities is job one. We know that that's complicated by the reality of drug addictions, alcoholism, mental illness, other problems, but it is job one. The eventual solution to homelessness is more is housing that is has services and goes under the rubric of supportive housing. And the sense is we need about 150,000 additional units of supportive housing now. And the last administration set out a goal to do about 15,000 a year or a year for 10 years or so of increased supportive housing units. They work. If you want to know the places that are doing the best job of supportive housing, it's places like Columbus, Ohio, where the Community Shelter Board has done a superb job of bringing people in from the streets to housing that has assistance with the mental issues, the addiction issues. Father Joe in San Diego is another example of quality supportive housing with services. It can be done. We can do a much better job of it across the country. The next iteration, I want to move through these quickly, is public housing. And while we've taken, I think, some important steps over the last decade with Hope 6, done about 260 Hope 6 projects across the country, including in Chicago, the transformation of Cabrini Green, the transformation of Henry Horner, of Robert Taylor Homes, of Ida B. Wells here in Chicago. But there are some really exemplary cases of where public housing renovation was undertaken not just as a project, but for a whole city, as what Renee Glover has done in Atlanta. You may have seen the New York Times piece last Sunday that talked about Atlanta as a breakthrough example of how to do an entire city strategy of replacing the worst of public housing. Baltimore has done it. Took down four major complexes. Each of them had about 10 high-rise buildings. They're down and replaced with smaller scale, defensible space, townhomes that have helped transform the center city of Baltimore. Louisville, Seattle, Denver, other examples of places that have done really exemplary jobs in integrating the renovation of public housing with larger city housing and economic strategies. A fourth kind of strategy deals with subsidized housing. And here's where preservation strategies come into play as the old subsidized FHA projects transition and are taken out of subsidized uses, no longer affordable. Finding ways to preserve them as affordable and finding ways to build more subsidized units. The most productive program we have in the country today for subsidized apartments is the low-income housing tax credits program. The administration has already started ways to revitalize the low-income housing tax credits program, but much more needs to be done because we need more subsidized rentals. Even though I'm in the home ownership business in my company, I would readily acknowledge that the most severe shortage of housing we have in the country today is affordable rentals, particularly in the gateway cities on both coasts. There's just an immense need, and we're just not producing it. In fact, we have a dearth of apartments at affordable prices, not just subsidized, even market generally, and it's a huge imperative that we proceed. The next piece of housing strategy would involve market rentals, building apartments, hopefully a good proportion of them affordable. Hard to do because of not-in-my-backyard opposition presently, because of the capital markets simply aren't, there isn't money available for construction of apartments. But the general sense is that by 2011 or so, it's going to be manifestly evident how badly we have underbuilt in apartments and how many are needed. So cities that are thinking ahead about how to work with the private sector to produce multifamily, and particularly affordable multifamily, mixed income multifamily, tied in sometimes to public housing, other times to home ownership strategies, et cetera. But market-priced, affordable rentals in the mix of housing strategies, critically important. The next piece is entry-level home ownership. We've done, I think, a good job as a country in the last few years. Obviously, that whole strategy is impacted now by the housing turndown and the foreclosure issues and the capital environment. Yet, it is possible to link these things together and focus on how to use some of the foreclosed stock, which some cities are doing, bringing nonprofits to bear to purchase bank-owned real estate and foreclosed real estate and transform it, fix it, renovate it, and make it available for new home ownership or rental strategies. And then finally, the final piece of the housing policy, which we don't have a lot of governmental policy or need a lot of governmental policy on, is the move-up house. And that market obviously hurt right now as well, but production will come back and we'll see builders coming back to production levels, presently very low. In normal years, we produce something like 1.2 million new units per year. We're down about 300,000, or a quarter of production at the moment. Level ramp up to production so that we don't hit huge affordability problems as people have gone out of business and there is no ability to ramp up as the economy returns, a hard thing to manage with interest rate policy and working with builders, but it's the kind of thing that localities at least have to keep in mind. So those are sort of the elements, if you will, of the things to think about if one is thinking about trying to put together comprehensive local housing strategies. Again, these things are possible. We know that they're being done in cities that are working on them thoughtfully and with competent staffs organized properly for it. It can be done. Let me wind down here by just hitting on a number of themes that I think we have to keep in mind as local housing officials. One is the affordability point. We witnessed a period in American life where housing was unaffordable for too many Americans. This is an interesting time. One would think that the affordability problems would be resolved in part, or at least addressed, by the lower prices. But the prices do not come down enough for Americans who are the neediest. And the fear is, as the housing market returns, because of the pent-up demand, because of the lack of production and supply, we're going to be back in another affordability fix. So keep an eye on the affordability issues as local officials. Secondly, the efficacy of smart growth strategies. Smart growth is an idea in housing whose time has come. And it is greatly important to local governments and cities. Because what it addresses is the need and the ability to create substantial housing at scale in local areas, whether it is related to transit sites, for example, and relates to the infrastructure strategies of cities and transportation strategies, whether it involves greening and sustainability, very important, in the materials used, in the location of housing. But it is clear that for a whole variety of reasons, including congestion, traffic, gas prices, et cetera, more and more people are coming into cities. This is a time when America's cities can, with intelligence and stewardship, take some major strides forward. And housing, smart housing strategies, is part of that equation. This is the time to be thinking about those things. This is the time to be planning and assembling strategies for land and partnerships to build smart housing in our cities. Still another thing to think about is the demographics that are changing so dramatically in our country. We see the growth of ethnic minorities, their ambitions to be the next middle class. I've already tried to make the link between accession to the middle class and housing policies, and the role of immigrants. A lot of housing experts see the growth of immigrants as one of the elements that will drive housing policy over the next years. That suggests differences in types of housing. Smaller scale, perhaps, to achieve what's called natural affordability. There was an analysis done by a group called Chicago 2020 here that looked at what people can afford and where it needs to be in contrast to projections of where housing will be. And what they suggest is what's planned is too large and too far out and unattached to the rest of the infrastructure of the city. What's needed is closer in, probably smaller scale in order to make it more affordable, but thoughtfully designed with multiple rooms for ethnic families with children and multiple generations. So really some creative work in actually what the housing itself ought to look like and where it ought to be located. One dimension of that will be housing for seniors. And I don't mean subsidized 202 units, but housing for seniors who want to live on their own, but not in the big house in the suburb. So perhaps, again, closer in, smaller scale, more dense, utilizing technology and environmental technologies to keep costs down, make them sustainable for a longer period of time. But we know that one part of the major part of the demographics going forward is the demographics of aging. And we haven't simply built enough stock that relates to the reality of our aging population. Still another thing to think about is the integration of housing in an overt way as a wealth strategy in our cities. It is critical in our cities, in our country, that we sustain the middle class. If we're going to help create that middle class out of the demographics of ethnic minorities and immigrants, then we need to recognize what tools are available to us to do that. And to the degree that housing is one of them, then keeping that door open, focusing on the financing techniques, the housing counseling and so forth, to get people into ownership and stable housing environments will be very, very key. It is more than just four walls that we build. It is the largest investment that people will make, and it is an element of how they will move upward in American life. And so to the degree that's important in our cities, and I fundamentally believe it is, then it needs to be thought through. It's not something that can be allowed, left to chance, allowed to occur just serendipitously. So the integration of housing as an income strategy, as a wealth strategy in our cities, as a strategy for economic integration of our future middle class, is critically important. Still another thing to think about as local officials is the integration to metropolitan strategies. Sharing of responsibilities for the homeless, for example. Sharing of responsibilities for subsidized housing. Utilizing metropolitan bases for dealing with Section 8 and public housing strategies. Critically important. One critical part of the housing equation that's almost never mentioned in discussion of local housing policy is fair housing, anti-discrimination strategies, critical problem when discrimination makes it impossible for people to be able to move across the metropolitan area to where opportunities are, where there is overt discrimination. And unfortunately, it still exists. There's just too much evidence from the use of testers who we send out to try to rent an apartment. A person arrives, college educated, plenty of income demonstrated, job base, but they're African American. And they're told by the landlord that the apartment that was advertised has just been rented. And they're just a few minutes too late, and it's not available any longer. A tester arrives with the same economic characteristics, the same job profile, the same age, same family composition, except they're white, and they go 2 hours later. And the landlord says, sure, let me get the key and show you the apartment. Unfortunately, that happens in America. We'd like to believe that we're past that, but it still occurs. And so fair housing strategies integrated into metropolitan strategies to really create the openness that's required across an entire metropolitan area are part of what need to be part and part of strategies in local housing policies. Finally, let me say with respect to what we ought to be thinking about is strategies for funding, including local funding. People like Mayor Daley have gone to great lengths to create strategies for funding out of a whole series of different resources. Miami has passed a housing trust fund. Austin, Texas has a housing trust fund. Very smart strategy there of categorizing what kind of housing, what kind of smart housing triggers use of local resources. There's very smart things being done across the country that link funding and authorities. For example, in King County, Washington, which is the county that surrounds Seattle, before any piece of municipal land is sold, it must first be analyzed for whether it can be made available for affordable housing or workforce housing. So a test is run, and then resources are matched to that. If it's found, it can be used that way. Intelligent work by Ron Sims, the person who is now Deputy Secretary of HUD, on his watch as county executive in King County. So the tools are there, the examples are there, the successes are there, the proof is there that local housing policies matched to intelligent state policies, working with the network of nonprofits and intermediaries like LISC and Enterprise, that very successful strategies can be organized at the local level to provide this critical resource that Americans, working Americans need. Four walls to call home, the economic investment it represents, and the spiritual place that will allow them to raise a family in stability, in safety, to enjoy all of those things that only a house can provide, a home can provide. Thank you very much for allowing me to bring these remarks, and I'll be happy to take questions before we head out to the reception. Thank you.